KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee will meet this month on March 22nd at 4:30.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a benefit for Right to Health on Sunday, March 25th at Mississippi Pizza in Portland. LaRonda Steele, 2-8 The Native, and Strike 9 will be performing as part of the While Rome Burns benefit for Right to Health. Right to Health breaks down barriers to health care by providing mobile health outreach services, workshops, research support, and more. Again, that's a benefit for Right to Health featuring LaRonda Steele, 2-8 The Native, and Strike 9 on Sunday, March 25th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
It's 8 o'clock.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In the lead-up to this year's midterm elections, a large number of insurgent candidates are facing off established incumbents in the primary elections this spring and summer. Many among them are progressives tired of Donald Trump and the GOP. On our show today, we'll hear from three such upstarts. First, Randy Bryce, who goes by Iron Stash, is an iron worker and union member and wants to unseat House Speaker Paul Ryan in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. Then, among the record number of women running in elections, we'll hear from one powerful woman of color, Saira Rao, facing off against an incumbent Democrat in Denver, Colorado. Finally, longtime privacy and civil rights advocate and activist Shahid Buttar will explain why he's challenging Nancy Pelosi in the California primary as a candidate for the state's 12th district representing San Francisco. That's coming up in just a moment. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A wave of progressive activists is running for congressional seats in this year's midterm elections, attempting to change the partisan makeup of the House and Senate. Among them is a man challenging House Speaker Paul Ryan in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. Sporting the moniker Iron Stash, an iron worker and U.S. Army veteran, Randy Bryce made waves recently when he raised money for his candidacy off of Ryan's tone-deaf tweet that boasted about helping a working woman make $1.50 extra a week in pay thanks to the Republican tax bill. Randy Bryce is hoping that his positions favoring single-payer health care, a $15 an hour minimum wage, and climate justice will garner enough support to oust Paul Ryan. Randy Bryce now joins me. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sonali. A pleasure to be with you.
So, of course, you have to first make it through the Democratic primary. You're running as a Democrat, and that primary is in the summer of this year. And we can talk about your challenges there. But why? Let's talk about why you have chosen to run for Congress. You, as far as I can tell, you have never held elected office before?
No. And the thing is that for the past 20 years, the time that Paul Ryan has been in Congress, he's been making friends and cozying up with special interests, with lobbyists, billionaires, and you're seeing the kind of legislation like this tax law that was just recently passed is helping those kinds of people out. And meanwhile, the last 20 years, I've been struggling with the people in the district, just trying to keep roofs over our heads. We've been working harder and harder every year, and we're having less and less to show for it.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. What does an iron worker do?
We do either placing rebar before the concrete's poured or structural iron workers, putting up the actual skeleton of a building. We do work on bridges, ornamental, stairs, basically anything to do with iron and placement on a construction job site.
And you've been doing this for a long time. You're also a union guy.
Correct. I belong to Ironworkers Local 8. We've been around for over 115 years, our union has, and I've been a member for 21 years. We've been going on 21 years now.
And you say on your website you're a cancer survivor, you're a U.S. Army veteran. So it's not just your career in construction and iron work that defines you. You have several other aspects to your life?
Correct. And all of them have recently been, you know, affected by what's going on with the government. When I had cancer, I was working two full-time jobs, and not one of those jobs provided any kind of health care. So it's being able to understand and deal with problems that everyday people face, something that Paul Ryan has no idea about, which was proven by that $1.50 a week tweet.
Right, and I want to get to that in just a minute, but the idea of how we struggle with our health care in this country is really quite barbaric. I mean, often for working people, for low-income people, for middle-income people, and sometimes even for upper-middle-income people, if you don't have really great health insurance, getting cancer essentially amounts to medical bankruptcy, right?
No, absolutely, and that's what it did do to me. Mm. And the thing is that it would be so much better. Every other industrialized nation has some kind of universal health care, and you can't tell me that the people of this country aren't deserving of being healthy. Mm. We could save so much money by allowing people to get checkups every year, which is something a lot of people don't do now because of the costs associated with it, if they are lucky to have health care. But we could catch so many things, earlier. Before they become a big problem, and also once we're actually pursuing being healthy, I can see us not being sent to have a lot of tests taken, which costs a lot of money, and it's the insurance system we have now is kind of crazy. The iron workers were self-insured, and we're paying an administrator to literally turn down our members' claims.
Wow. Now, you are also a U.S. Army veteran. Tell me a little bit about that. And wouldn't you have qualified for the VA, which is essentially government health care for veterans?
Right. The thing of it is that I didn't know that I had cancer when I went in. Because I didn't have insurance, I didn't go get checked out. But by the time it was diagnosed, the doctor said, this is something we need to take care of right away. So there wasn't any time to go through the paperwork that was needed through the VA.
So we are hearing news that the government, after having passed its two-year budget, Congress has written a giant check to the military. Donald Trump has released on Monday his vision for the federal government budget that includes an infrastructure plan, but essentially reduces domestic spending and greatly boosts military spending. What do you make of the financial priorities of this government, of this particular administration?
Well, that's the whole thing right there. We're seeing where their priorities are. And it's not about taking care of the people in this country. The amount of money we spend on our military is something else. And I could see a lot better uses for it than not just blowing up things across the world, but then, spending money to go fix it. Let's let's reinvest in the United States. Let's, I mean, we see the past 21 years as an iron worker, I've seen with my own eyes what kind of condition our roads, our bridges are in. I know that we're having problems just getting drinkable water that, you know, doesn't contain lead. Our infrastructure is huge, and there's a lot of it that's just becoming dilapidated, and we need to reinvest in the United States. Let's help ourselves out.
So Paul Ryan thought that he was identifying with American working class people when he tweeted some days ago that a woman in Pennsylvania would be making $1.50 more per week in her paycheck because of his new tax law. He quickly deleted that tweet. Why did this tweet bother you and so many Americans?
It shows exactly how out of touch Paul Ryan has become. And it wasn't just that tweet, which we were able to, I mean, we took advantage of it. We raised close to $200,000, and half of that was $1.50 at a time, too. But he's shown that he's out of touch with people in a district. He didn't know when he was in New York, he was asked what the minimum wage was in Wisconsin, right after telling the interviewer that we couldn't afford to raise it. So he was asked, what is the minimum wage in Wisconsin? He wasn't aware of that. And also there was a CNN event that they had last year with Jake Tapper that in the district, but it wasn't a public town hall, where he was talking up a community called Cristo Rey. And the problem with that, he said that they did a lot of good work in the community. Well, it was a Latino parish that hasn't been in existence for over 3 years. It's just another example of him showing that he's clearly out of touch with the people here. And not only do his policies reflect that, but they're actually hurting us.
And so you called out Paul Ryan on that tweet, pointed out that he deleted the tweet. Tell us how you fundraised on the back of that tweet and what response you got.
Well, what we did was we had a screenshot of it and we reposted it and asked people to chip in $1.50 if they would, if they agreed that Paul Ryan was out of touch. And so they did. Within 48 hours, we raised pretty close to $200,000.
And about $1.50 contributions?
About half of them. About half of the contributions were $1.50.
That's huge.
Right. It is. And on one hand, it shows what $1.50 can do, but it's, you know, at the same time, it's just being so out of touch that him really thinking $6 a month is going to help somebody do a lot more than just pay for their Costco membership.
Right. Yeah. He basically cited that the woman who was pleased about having $1.50 extra per week said it would more than cover her yearly Costco membership. So we see the ways in which this particular tax bill is going to be used by Republicans as a way to garner votes in the midterm elections. This was their one major legislative win, the other being the spending bill that just passed. But the Republicans are banking on some benefits to the middle class to show that they are, you know, that they can continue to retain the House and the Senate. They're hoping that will lead them to retain the House and Senate. Do you think that will play out, especially given that people may not start really seeing benefits till next year, or may not really know how big their benefits are till their tax bill next year?
No, I think what's going to happen, we're informing people that what they're going to have is only temporary. And it's really not going to be much of a benefit when they see that they'll get $1,000 as a result of the tax scam, but they're going to have to pay, let's say, like $4,000 more for health care. The Republicans are counting on this, but the word is getting out. It's a very unpopular law right now.
So what are some of the issues that you are making clear you stand for? Because this was a big part of Democrats' problems. The Democratic Party has had trouble clarifying, the establishment Democrat Party, I should say, has trouble putting their vision out to the public clearly. It's supposed to be the liberal alternative to the Republican Party, but you don't have every Democrat saying, therefore, single-payer health care, etc. So how do you outline your vision in contrast to that of Paul Ryan's for this country?
Well, what we're doing is going to benefit people in a district. And some of the things that we're looking at doing, infrastructure is very important for us. Again, having done this kind of work for 21 years, I know what kind of condition our roads and bridges are in. And every time I drive underneath the bridge, I look up, and too often I see, you know, like the rebar rusting, bleeding onto the cracked concrete. But it's a way to put people to work. They're great careers. Apprenticeships through the building trades are phenomenal sources of training. They cost no tax dollars. And at the end of graduation, the person has a career that they can walk. They can go to work any place in North America. There's no student loans that have to get repaid after it's over with. And we have a hotline set up to find out where workers are needed. Another thing is making sure, you know, raising our minimum wage. I'm in favor of a $15 minimum wage because people that work full time shouldn't have to live in poverty. And of course, Medicare for All is something that I'm in favor of, and we're seeing more and more people come out, whether they're already in Congress or candidates, seeing that this is something that we can't afford to do. It's something that, you know, we can't afford not to do.
How important is it for ordinary people to feel that running for office is within their reach? I mean, we had a reality TV star and failed businessman feel that he was qualified enough for job of president. He's proving that he's entirely unqualified, but he was able to win the election. And members of Congress like Paul Ryan have, you know, sort of given Donald Trump a pass because they're able to use him to get their policies through. Is it up to us, you know, people who may not have experience with elected office, to try to take back Congress, even if it means we don't win, just to move the conversation in the right direction?
Absolutely. I mean, I am planning on winning. I understand it's going to be a tough race. It's an uphill fight all the way, but working hard is something I've done for my entire life. We do need more people, more working class people with working class values. That's what I see as our biggest problem now in the government. And I'm being contacted by a lot of people, everyday working people, that are saying, is this something I should do? Can you help me out? And there's a network being set up of helping other everyday people that want to run for office and take back the country from the direction that it's headed.
And what sort of support have you gotten from the Democratic Party, which has not always been eager to support very progressive candidates? The party, the National Committee, has come under fire for still trying to woo sort of centrist Democrats and centrists, political centrists rather than strong progressives.
Well, very early on, we were endorsed by Congressman Mark Pocan's Progress and the Progressive Caucus. Hmm. Members of Congress have been very helpful as far as reaching out, helping mentor and build connections that are going to help me once getting elected. But we've been getting contacted by a lot of very progressive groups as well, whether it's like the Working Families Party, Democracy for America, NARA, we've been supported by Vote Vets. There's been quite a bit of national support and labor support too within the district, because I have had, so that's something I have been able to bring with me, is strong labor and veteran ties from already being involved with the community.
In many ways, Randy, you fit the demographic of the American working class base that we have been told over the past couple of years is struggling so much that they threw their weight behind Donald Trump and are, you know, excited about this inexperienced president disrupting the way things are done. But you are the opposite. Your politics are the opposite of those people who voted for Trump, even if your demographic hallmarks might be similar. Any comment on that?
Well, yeah, when I talk with people, a lot of them who did vote for Trump also voted for Obama. They tell me that they like the message. First of all, they like being paid attention to, and they like Donald Trump's message of draining the swamp. The thing is that not only was he dishonest about pretty much everything he made on his way to being elected, but people are also seeing that when he drained the swamp, what he filled it back up with is a lot more toxic than swamp water. And they're seeing Paul Ryan as the largest swamp monster that's still living there that needs to be removed.
Hmm. And do you feel that that working class white Americans in particular are going to be disillusioned by Trump enough that they might support candidates like you because they care about higher minimum wage and care about single payer health care?
Well, when I refer to working class, I consider it, being a very diverse working class. The district is primarily white, but this isn't, our race is making sure to be inclusive of everybody. And instead of this divide and conquer that Donald Trump has been doing, we're bringing everybody together and moving us all ahead. And as we said it in our first video, everybody's going to fall down at some time, and we're going to pick those people up because we're going to need people to pick us up when it's our turn to fall down.
So you've also included in your platform women's health care and reproductive rights and comprehensive immigration reform. How critical is that? Because, again, this is going in the opposite direction to what Trump is trying to take the country. And to an extent, Paul Ryan, because Paul Ryan's happy to go along with Trump, no matter how compassionate he claims he is on the issue of immigration.
No, and that's the big thing. It's you can't divide people up and then once you win an election, try to bring them together if that's how you got to where you are. So we're stating very early on that we're about building coalitions and making sure that, because civilizations are judged on how they treat the most vulnerable. And that's why we need to protect the dreamers, the people that were brought here average age 6 years old, and this is the only country they know. We're the adults, and we need to look after those that are coming after us. So it's very important to let everybody know that they have a place at the table.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Randy Bryce is a congressional candidate for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, challenging Paul Ryan. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Hundreds of women are running for the House of Representatives nationwide in primary races leading up to this year's midterm elections. At the latest count, there are more than twice the number running this year than in 2016. Women are fired up to run for office under Donald Trump's presidency, and the fact that a large majority of those running are doing so as Democrats suggests they're ready to challenge the GOP agenda. My guest, Saira Rao, is one of those women, but she's running as a Democrat, ready to challenge the Democratic Party as well. Rao, who is a first-generation Indian American, was a stalwart supporter and activist with the Democratic Party, and then last December, she published a provocative piece in the Huffington Post entitled, "I Am a Brown Woman Who's Breaking Up with the Democratic Party." Saira Rao now joins me. She's running for Congress in Colorado's 1st District, facing incumbent Diana DeGette in the June primary. She's a co-founder of In This Together Media, former clerk for the U.S. Court of Appeals. She's done a number of things, her latest being running for office. Welcome to the program, Saira.
Thanks, Sonali. What a nice introduction.
Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, before we get to why you decided to run for Congress, why did you break up with the Democratic Party? In the piece that you wrote in the Huffington Post last December, you featured a photograph of yourself grinning proudly with Hillary Clinton.
Yep. Yeah, so I should say I had broken up with the Democratic Party establishment, which remains true. I think we have two fights this year and going forward. One is the obvious one, turning red districts blue. But equally important is turning blue districts really bright blue. And I think this is a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. The party used to be of the people, communities of color, the poor, the disenfranchised. And now, with all of the money that both parties take, including the Democratic Party, from corporations, I think that it's really moved to be a sort of more centrist and for the corporations that support it.
So you have decided to challenge an incumbent for the Democratic nomination. Why are you running as a Democrat?
I'm running as a Democrat because I think we can take the party back. I think progressives can take the party back if we can get the money, the corporate dark money, out of the party and return it to a party of the people. Then, you know, I'm very happy to be a Democrat. I'm a proud Democrat. I've been a Democrat forever. But being disappointed by the way things have gone and by the fact that we Americans have been ignored at the expense of big pharma, insurance companies, real estate developers, I'm fighting to get the party back to where it belongs, which is with the American people.
So do you in a way place part of the blame for the Trump presidency, for the GOP agenda getting so much traction, on the Democrats as well?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Sonali. After I wrote that article, I was blown away by the response. It went totally viral. I got so many emails. They're still pouring in. And the response was sort of in three categories. One was the mainstream centrist party establishment telling me to F off and goodbye, sort of to the other extreme, which we should all be deeply concerned about: Black, white, brown, gay, straight, male, female, all different ages. Wrote to me and continue to write to me saying, you know what, we're with you. We used to think that the Democratic Party was the lesser of two evils, and now in many respects we think they're worse because at least Republicans are openly horrible and we're no longer voting. That is where it becomes scary. We're no longer voting. What happens in that situation? And then sort of the middle group, why don't you run for office, Syra? And I thought to myself at first, can't we expect more from our representatives? Is the answer always just go for it? And then over the Christmas holiday, something occurred to me. My issue with these Democrats who've been in Congress for decades, there is no term limit on this institution, and the party makes it so that they do not support people, non-incumbents in primaries. So you have a situation where people are in Congress, we're paying their salaries, they're there for decades, they're supported by corporations, they literally don't represent us, and they're not using their power and privilege of 100% safe seats to advocate for the disenfranchised. That's my beef. And I thought, oh my gosh, here I am in a situation where I'm not 25, I'm 43, I have class privilege so I can pay for childcare, I have a supportive family, and I have the power to actually challenge the status quo. If I don't do that, then I'm just as bad as they are.
So in your piece,
I think that these career Democrats who have been in power forever and ever and ever are not representing the people. And that is a big reason we lost in 2016, no doubt.
Now, your piece in the Huffington Post, and I want to get to the fact that race is a central part of your campaign. Your piece is entitled, I'm a Brown Woman Who's Breaking Up with the Democratic Party, not just a woman. And you write, for every Kamala Harris and Pramila Jayapal sticking their brown and black necks out for me, there are dozens of white female Democrats who want me to shut my trap. How have you been challenged? And I've been looking at your Facebook page, by the way. You're very bold. You're very, you don't hold back, particularly in the issue of race. Why is race such a central issue for you? And how have you found that when you do bring up the issue of race, it's often white liberals that are upset with you?
Yeah, I think, and again, I've had this sort of awakening after the catastrophe of November 2016. And I realized after the election that I had been a white feminist my whole life. And when I started bringing up racial justice issues with my white liberal female friends, they were loath to discuss it. And it made them very defensive. And what we're finding, it's really interesting, even with the Me Too movement and Time's Up, white feminists are very outspoken now on, and rightly so, on issues of sexual harassment and sexual assault. But when brown and black women talk about issues of racial justice, we are told that we are being impolite. We are told that we are too angry. I am told that every single day by white liberal people, mostly women, actually. Maybe if you could tone it down, Syra. And it's incredibly hypocritical, right? Because in many respects, white feminists are expecting men to hear their anger, their righteous, real anger, but aren't affording brown and black women the same, you know, courtesy of hearing what we experience, which is woefully different. You know this, Sonali, you're a brown woman too, woefully different than what white women experience.
Did the election of 2016 bring to light for you as an Indian American, not just a brown woman, but an Indian American, that, you know, a lot of Indians who are the part of this sort of stereotypical model minority suddenly find that they have much more in common with African Americans and Latino Americans, with Native Americans, than with white America, even though in many ways we as an ethnic group have taken up the same class space for many decades. I mean, you were raised to in the country to be you know, to feel like anything was available to you if you just worked hard enough. But of course, your brownness will get in the way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So a few things happened the days after the election that really stuck out in my mind. Number one, my late mother was called the N-word on Facebook.
Wow.
My mom served our country for 34 years as a doctor at the Veterans Administration. She was called that on Facebook. My husband was called a terrorist and told to go back to his country, which incidentally is America. Mm. And we had a family friend, Indian family friend in D.C., 12-year-old, who got accosted by a drunk white frat guy on the metro on his way to school, and it got captured on video. My daughter heard my husband and I talking about this. I was crying, and she became convinced that her daddy was going to be killed for being black. I brought it up with her teachers. They didn't want to talk about it at school. They never addressed it, ever. And it occurred to me that I had no idea what it was like to be black in this country, and I still don't have any idea. But I have a little clue as to what it's like. And it's terrible. Class privilege is amazing, but when you are walking while brown or black, when you're driving while brown or black, it's a very different thing. And it's curious about the Indian thing, because, you know, you realize how we're sort of surrounded by so much hate in so many different directions. And I've had relatives in India who have trouble accepting my point of view, which is we can't be bigoted towards Muslims, and they have their own issues in India. And at some point, you kind of feel like you're not making anyone happy, and you're getting attacked by everyone just because you're taking a stance against bigotry across the board in every single form.
Let's talk about your campaign platform. So part of this conversation on race, you have very openly and overtly said you support Black Lives Matter and ending police brutality, ending the death penalty. Tell me a little bit about how you want to advance racial justice through your candidacy, and if you make it to Congress, through your congressional position.
So, you know, for a living, I create diverse mindset that story matters, narrative matters, words matter a lot. And
you're the co-founder of In This Together Media.
Right. In This Together Media. What I believe first and foremost needs to happen is we as Americans collectively have to say Black Lives Matter, Brown Lives Matter. And the fact that most people, including white liberals, cannot and will not say that. One of my daughter's coaches told me last week, he's a white liberal guy, he would support my campaign if I would take Black Lives Matter off my website. So that gives you a sense of what we're talking about here. If we can start saying that and start meaning that and start marching for BLM, that's a great first step. In terms of criminal justice reform, so much of that is based in racism and white supremacy. We have to start talking about it. So when we talk about what happens when I get to Congress, I think we dialogue has dropped out altogether. And we're all kind of having these Band-Aid solutions to a endemic problem that stems, frankly, from the fact that our country was founded on genocide of indigenous people. Thereafter, we had slavery, and we've never, ever, ever had a truth and reconciliation in this country. And I think it's high time that we do that. And I think as a culture, we need to do that. And I think Congress needs to set the example and the stage for that.
Saira, how would you, in your opinion, be a better Democratic representative than the incumbent you are running against, Diana DeGette?
Sure. Number one, I'm not taking corporate PAC money.
And she is, yes.
And I've been offered it, and it's really interesting. I've turned it down. And then, you know, I spend the day on the phone trying to raise money in $27 donations. And you realize the allure of why people do that. But guess what happens when you do that? You take the money, and then that PAC and the people behind it, those are your constituents. And that's not just a matter of process. That's a matter of substance. So when we sit back and ask, why do we still have an opioid crisis? Why don't we have healthcare in this country? It's largely because people in Congress on both sides are taking tons of money from big pharma and insurance companies. Why are we still dependent on fossil fuels? My sense is that we're taking a ton of money from oil and natural gas. So the fact that I'm not doing that is a major, major thing, number one. Number two, representation matters. And Colorado has never sent a woman of color to Congress. And again, representation
matters. The entire state has never sent a woman of color? Not just your district? Wow.
No, the entire state. Chew on that, right? And there are 9 members of Congress right now, and every single one of those people are white. And I would argue that having a non-white woman in Congress from Colorado would be more representative of actually what my district looks like right now. I think 23 years is a long time for anyone to be in any kind of a job. And the incumbent's been here, that she's going on year number 23. It's time for a change. This district, District 1 of Colorado, is incredibly progressive. It's diverse in all forms. And I think it's time for a true progressive to represent a truly progressive district.
So you have chosen not to take PAC money, money from political action committees, which is essentially corporate money. How well have you been doing in raising funds?
Well, we've been doing great, actually. My message is really resonating, which is exciting. And, you know, I had a guy a couple weeks ago say, I have $10, this is a Wednesday, $10 between now and Friday. And he gave me $3 of that $10. It broke my heart, but he did it online.
Oh,
and he said, it matters. Representation matters. You matter. And my whole thing is, once we're able to get corporate PAC money out of the game, everybody needs a seat at the table. Why are we in a situation? We have affordable housing crises all over the country. Every burgeoning city has one. And why don't we have a situation where everybody who has a vested interest in that neighborhood gets a seat at the table? So it's not just real estate developers walking away feeling like the 100% winner and everyone else feels like the loser. Why don't we have people like who own businesses there, and residents, and the real estate developers, and the mayors, and the city council members? And as a member of Congress, I could sort of put all that together, kind of bring people together, and everyone can feel 70% happy rather than one person winning and one person losing. We've got to stop doing that. We can actually all come to a consensus.
Good luck to you, Saira.
Thanks, Sonali.
Saira Rao is running for Congress in Colorado's 1st District, challenging incumbent Diana DeGette. She's the co-founder of In This Together Media. She's been a former clerk for the U.S. Court of Appeals. She's a first-generation Indian American, and we've been discussing her candidacy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi became the only woman to ever be House Speaker and hopes after this year's midterm elections to retake that position. The House Minority Leader, who represents California's very liberal-leaning 12th District, is now facing another hurdle on her way to retaking the House, a grassroots challenger in the June primary. My guest, Shahid Buttar, has been a longtime critic of Pelosi, who he has accused of enabling continued violations of privacy and civil rights, particularly during the past few years. As Democrats attempt to take on Republicans in the November elections, how will they fare against progressives running to their left earlier in the year? Well, Shahid Buttar joins me. He is the congressional candidate for California's 12th District, currently on leave as director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Before that, he served as executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and he's been a guest on our program before, usually as a guest expert, today as a candidate. Welcome to the program, Shahid.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali. It's always great to be with you.
Well, I have to confess, I was very surprised to see that you would be running for election. You are a longtime activist, somebody who is agitated from the outside. What led you to make this decision to jump into the electoral fray?
At the end of the day, I've watched my city's congressional representative undermine the interests of constitutional rights and immigrants too many times. It really just became impossible to watch from the sidelines. And I felt compelled to throw my hat in the ring. I at least want to make sure that if my city is going to be represented by a pillar of the corporate establishment, that it doesn't happen without a fight.
So the outline for us the problems with Nancy Pelosi's position on, in particular, issues that you've been fighting for many years, which is the right to privacy, the fight against surveillance of ordinary Americans, the NSA's infractions into ordinary people's lives. What is Nancy Pelosi's position on these issues?
So, you know, she talks big game about resistance to the Trump administration. But unfortunately, it seems that for the incumbent, resistance is just a hashtag to be claimed when it's convenient and abandoned also whenever it's convenient. It was just a month ago that in her capacity as the House Minority Leader, Nancy Pelosi helped kill an opportunity to finally impose a judicial warrant requirement so that FBI, NSA, and DEA searches of Americans would have to be approved by a judge first. By killing that reform, she basically handed to the Trump administration on a silver platter, not just extended surveillance powers, but also expanded surveillance powers. And watching that discrete vote and her role in it, that was the particular event that pushed me into running. It was just so infuriating, I couldn't stand by.
So tell us what the landscape, political landscape looks like for June. Nancy Pelosi has held her position for decades, and she, you know, still, I think, touts this image of being this renegade, you know, rebellious leader who the liberal constituency that she represents should be proud of. Right. Does she face any other challenge besides you among the Democrats?
She does, but just to answer your first question, Nancy Pelosi represents the most liberal and progressive district in the United States, and she has a reputation of being the House's most liberal member, but the shoe does not fit. In fact, the liberal shoe at all does not fit. You can't vote for mass surveillance or turn the other way on CIA torture, both of which she's done, and still claim to be a liberal. It is profoundly incongruous that someone with so decidedly corporate a position is representing so liberal and progressive a city. And that's exactly why I'm running. There are other challengers who have filed campaigns to seek this seat. One of them, I think, is a five-time contender representing the Green Party. Another one is 24 years old, and the last has no experience on any of the issues that we're raising. So I'm quite confident that we'll have the opportunity to square off against Representative Pelosi through November.
Now, is it just her position on civil rights, or is it other issues as well? You mentioned CIA torture. Let's talk about that. What exactly is her position on it? What is your critique of what she has, you know, positions she has taken? When we hear CIA torture, we think of the Republican Party and the Bush administration, first and foremost, George W. Bush, although, of course, not enough was done on accountability under Obama.
Yeah, unfortunately, CIA torture and impunity for it and ongoing violations of our international human rights treaties are a bipartisan commitment. Both Republicans and Democrats have shielded human rights abusers from accountability. In doing that, they have basically cost the world the victory that the United States fought a world war to establish so many years ago. And Nancy Pelosi, as the House Minority Leader and at different points the Speaker of the House, was fully read into all of the covert programs that the national security agencies pursue, and she did nothing about it. So it's not her position, it's her lack of a position, and it's her lack of action. A consistent theme of my concerns about the incumbent is precisely that the rhetoric does not match the reality. It was just a few weeks ago, in fact, probably last week or maybe the week before, that she performed a media stunt basically talking for 8 hours about the rights of immigrant students while engineering a backroom deal to throw us under the bus. And the
you're talking about the sort of filibuster style speech that she gave on the floor of the House, holding up votes on the spending bill while she read testimonies of dreamers who were DACA registrants. And you're saying that she was conducting a backroom deal at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, at the same time that she was talking on the House floor, she was one of the architects of the budget deal that ended up passing the House without any protections for dreamers. So you might say that she's talking out of one side of her mouth while doing very different things.
Didn't she vote against
it? In action. She voted against it in her individual capacity, but she's the House Minority Leader, meaning that in her capacity as the head of the party, she didn't champion dreamers' interests using her office. That's exactly my point, is it's easy as a politician to say one thing and do another. And that's unfortunately precisely what the incumbent has done for decades.
It's interesting. Even the New York Times saw through the hypocrisy of her position on the spending bill, pointing out that Democrats did not stick together. 73 of them voted for the spending bill, thus ensuring its passage. Of course, huge chunks of Republicans didn't vote for it. So had Pelosi's fellow Democrats not voted for it, that spending bill wouldn't have passed. Before the bill passed, she said, one lawmaker said that she said, we're better when we stick together. After it passed, Nancy Pelosi said in an interview, we had a great bill. We got everything. Republicans gave away the store. But of course, they didn't give anything to Dreamers, and they gave lots to the military.
Right. There's never been a military funding request that Nancy Pelosi hasn't liked. And unfortunately, it's not just NSA. It's not just immigrants. You know, she's very consistently undermined the rights of her constituents.
Now, she, as House Minority Leader, you know, so she's basically the second after Paul Ryan in how much power she may be wielding politically. What capacity does she have? When we've seen how Republicans operate when they're the minority party, they are pretty disciplined. Does Nancy Pelosi, you think, have the leverage that we want her to have in holding firm all of her fellow Democrats to, you know, unite around certain issues, to present this progressive vision that she's, you know, claiming her reputation gives her?
I am ultimately less interested in the incumbent's failures to use her leverage. It's precisely why we're mounting an alternative. She certainly has a great deal of leverage over Democrats. She's a renowned vote whipper. It's just that when push comes to shove on issues of crucial concern to Americans, like whether or not we have an opportunity to have a private conversation or whether democracy will survive this administration, she doesn't show up. She does certainly have a great deal of influence over other Democrats that she hasn't used to effectuate the resistance that she's been so willing to claim in rhetoric.
Shahid, tell me how you feel you would be best suited to represent California's 12th congressional district. You mentioned earlier it is the most liberal district in the country. So what are your qualifications to somebody who's, you know, willing to see Nancy Pelosi be stripped of her title?
Thanks for asking. You know, I've been an issue advocate promoting the constitutional rights of all Americans for decades. You know, resistance is more than just a hashtag for me. It's something to which I'm thoroughly committed, and it's something that I've demonstrated. I've been fighting not just on the outside, but also on the inside, even without a seat in Congress, my entire career. I was one of the first advocates to file a legal challenge seeking marriage equality for same-sex couples. I've done a lot of work challenging mass surveillance by the NSA, as well as targeted surveillance by the FBI, which has historically been very politicized and undermined the civil rights of particular communities, from people who've resisted civil rights abuses to people who've sought to change U.S. foreign policy and address wars that we've initiated abroad. I've beyond those issues, I've also, in my art as a musician, raised socially conscious themes. From, you know, one of my first songs that I recorded was the Baghdad Blues, about the plights of military families whose breadwinners are called to serve in armed service. Have a funk tune about climate change and militarism. And as an organizer, beyond my advocacy and beyond my art, I've been helping build grassroots coalitions to champion constitutional rights across the country for a decade. And I'm very thoroughly committed to precisely the principles that the incumbent, unfortunately, is undermining in practice.
So you have lived in the Bay Area for many years. You, I understand, went to Stanford Law School. How does, you would imagine that your politics would resonate very well with the constituencies that live there. And yet, you know, even in very liberal parts of the country, we see establishment Democrats become, be able to take power. Often they get the finances from their, corporate campaign donors. So it ends up becoming about money. And then the person that we send to Washington, D.C. just doesn't capture enough of the vision that the constituents represent. So how are you going to overcome that challenge? Because unfortunately, it comes down to money time and again.
It doesn't entirely come down to money. And you're certainly right to note that I'm vastly outgunned at the outset. And Nancy Pelosi is the most renowned corporate fundraiser in the House. And I'm a working class public interest advocate. That notwithstanding, two other resources that matter in political campaigns are ideas and volunteers. And we will easily beat the incumbent with respect to ideas. You know, it's not just the constitutional rights of Americans or immigrants or corporate corruption that we're challenging. It's also the prison industrial slavery complex. And Americans are done with corporate co-optation of our democracy. With respect to volunteers, I suspect that we will mobilize a substantial swath of our congressional district. And as for the money, I think there is a substantial chunk of, for instance, the tech community, of, for instance, Muslims, peace and justice activists. San Francisco is a very mobilized city. And across the different segments of our community, people share my concerns. And I certainly am quite confident that the strongest corporate fundraiser in the House will outpace us with respect to her fundraising. As long as we can raise enough funds to get our message out, I'm very confident that we'll be competitive. San Franciscans are the last people in the country who want to continue the failed and racist war on drugs. We're the last people in the country who would be willing, for instance, to call a government whistleblower who resigned his career to point out the co-optation of the internet as a surveillance platform a traitor, as Nancy Pelosi has done. We're the last people in the country who want to see Washington continue to run roughshod over the rights of us and other Americans. And I'm very hopeful that, provided an alternative, the people of my community will agree with me that together we can do better.
Shahid, how do you view your candidacy within the national framework of people mounting challenges to establishment lawmakers, whether they're those establishment lawmakers are Republican or Democrat, whether the challengers are like yourself, progressive or not? There seems to be the polarization in our country politically seems to really have created an increased energizing among the electorate, which can only be a good thing, right? Because for far too long, those who've been in power and just easily sailed to re-election have relied on the non-participation of a majority of Americans. More Americans don't vote than vote.
Right. You're absolutely right. And I think that ultimately, our campaign is as much to dislodge and hopefully remove a corporate pillar of the establishment as it is to win real representation for San Francisco. I certainly hope to see San Francisco's voice in the House be a more full-throated progressive voice. At the same time, just to be clear here, Nancy Pelosi has been so in bed with the corporate power structure of Washington that I'm actually running both to her left and her right at the same time.
How so?
You know, well, so for instance, a vote to restrain executive power in order to prevent the NSA from monitoring the communications and browsing history of everyone in the world, that's not a particularly progressive position. That's actually a conservative position. It conserves the Fourth Amendment rights to which our country has long been committed. Similar, you know, restraints on executive power.
Your definition of conservative so then harkens to the original definition rather than what is passing for conservatism as per Republicans today.
Right. And both conservative and liberal as descriptors have been thoroughly shorn from their roots, right? Liberals are people who are supposed to promote liberty, and conservatives are people who are supposed to conserve a social structure. The conservatives in our country are quite radical now, and the liberals in our country are quite co-opted now. Progressives are people who seek a brighter day, and I plan to do that too. But at the same time, I'm also just trying to hold the line on basic constitutional rights that all of Washington seems entirely too willing to compromise. The right wing has said for a long time in the context of jurisprudence that expands the rights of Americans that if liberals want to see policy changes, they should amend the Constitution. No one's passed a constitutional amendment to say that Americans should no longer have a right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. No one's passed a constitutional amendment to say that we shouldn't have a right to assembly or a right to speech. But what does the right to assembly look like after the Occupy movement, which was just denied it? What does the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures look like when the NSA is monitoring everything you do online or all of your phone calls? No one's passed amendments to end the rights that have long made our country a beacon of freedom to the rest of the world. But in practice, both liberals and conservatives have abandoned their respective commitments to champion what are ultimately authoritarian policies. And my candidacy is as much about defending democracy as it is about promoting constitutional rights or challenging corporate corruption.
Now, Shahid, though, Donald Trump has been evoked as the, you know, incredibly demonic figure against which, you know, first Hillary Clinton tried to win an election and failed. And now the Democrats seem to be using that same playbook, which is vote for us because we're not Donald Trump. Vote for us because, you know, it's better to have us, better the devil, you know, they might as well come out and say, of course they don't say that, than Trump's continued power and his Republican Party, which enables him so much, their continued power. And you might come across those people who challenge your candidacy saying, I support you, I agree with you, but I just can't risk Nancy Pelosi not being there to, you know, hold off a Republican challenger. Just can't risk you getting to the general election and losing to a Republican. How do you respond to that?
Well, let's just be clear. As long as Nancy Pelosi is the leader of the Democrats, the resistance will be shackled. She talks about resistance, but as we've discussed, she doesn't effectuate it in practice. And similarly, if Democrats take the House and someone else is the Speaker, that will be to the benefit of the country and the party. So if people are concerned about Trump, as they should be, because he is a maniacal kleptocrat and serial rapist and longtime committer of fraud, if you're serious about being concerned about Trump, that's exactly why we shouldn't send a pillar of the corporate establishment back to Washington. We can do better than that. You know, resistance for me is not just a talking point. It's not a hashtag. It's something to which I've been committed across multiple struggles in multiple theaters for a long time and with a seat in Congress, particularly an opportunity to do in oversight hearings what members of Congress have been so unwilling to do. I think I could do a great deal to empower resistance in Washington and meaningfully check and balance this president. I should make clear here, you know, it's worth noting, I've asked questions about corruption and the rule of law that no member of Congress has ever asked in Senate hearing chambers, and I've been arrested for it. At the end of the day, resistance is exactly why San Franciscans should send me to Washington, because it is under this maniacal criminal president in particular that we must have full-throated constitutional progressivism being championed, especially on behalf of our country's most progressive city in the nation's capital.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
Shahid Buttar is a candidate in the primary election for California's 12th congressional district, currently on leave as director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've been discussing his challenge to Nancy Pelosi. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Good morning, it's 8:59. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly news and commentary program, digging deep into the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia. 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers today, Ken Jones welcomes Panio Giannopoulos, author of the story collection, How to Get Into Our House and Where We Keep the Money. At 11:30, the film show speaks with two of the creators of Portlandia as that television show comes to an end. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. It's 9 o'clock. Press Watch is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Feet to the Fire campaign and protest on Friday, March 23rd, 10 a.m. at the Washington County Courthouse in Hillsboro, Oregon. The monthly Feet to Fire campaign is part of a national campaign started by Protect Our Stolen Treasures out of Detroit to hold district attorneys accountable for protecting us against police violence and hate crimes. This peaceful protest outside one of the county courthouses calls for justice for those lost to police violence and hate crimes. Again, that's Feet to the Fire campaign and protest on Friday, March 23rd, 10 a.m. at the Washington County Courthouse, 145 Northeast 2nd Avenue in Hillsboro, Oregon. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Americana singer-songwriter Libby Roderick, Saturday, March 24th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Libby Roderick is an internationally known environmental and peace activist and musician. This concert contributes toward building community through music.